or a tunnel into a cave. If we're camping, surely there's going to be a cave involved, right? Since we're training to be familiar with caverns and ruins and such things. This is the perfect spot of land for terrain practice, Magpie declares, rubbing her hands together.
You always did love terrain practice.
Hawk says from nearby. I want to turn to look at him, but my face feels rather hot again. And instead, I tug on my collar, trying to get air in my blouse. Sure is warm here. Terrain practice? Meriden asks, glancing over at Lark, who shrugs. Terrain practice, Magpie repeats. Gwenna slings her pack off her back, ever the hard worker. Great. Shall we set up tents and get started then?
No tents just yet. It's too bright out.
Magpie squints at the sky. It's sunset, I point out. At my side, Kip snorts, and I don't know if he's amused or irritated. Magpie just grins at me. She's got deep hollows under her eyes, and her skin has a greenish cast to it. But if she feels poorly, she's hiding it well.
Sunset, aye. We want it to be fully dark.
Why? Gwenna blurts.
Because it ain't well lit in a tunnel,
Magpie says, enunciating each word slowly.
Just like it ain't all even and level, either, or dry. Some tunnels are wet, some are nothing but rocks. There's nothing about it that's easy. So we're going to keep those packs on your backs.
She points at Gwenna's pack, indicating she should put it back on.
And then we're going to go marching up the stream. The water here is only ankle deep. It makes the rocks slippery and treacherous, which means it's perfect terrain practice. I haven't been in a tunnel yet that's as smooth and easy to navigate as the streets of Vast Warren.
Considering that the streets of Vast Warren are cobbled, terribly cobbled, I might add, and slant heavily, this is a rather alarming piece of news. And we do this in the dark? Meriden asks, her voice timid.
It's all good, Mare.
Lark says in a confident voice.
We'll be tied together, just like in the caves, right?
Exactly, Master Magpie says. You're getting it now.
But it's going to be too dark to see anything, I point out. I can barely see as it is. In the dark, I'll just be stumbling. Magpie turns to me.
Then light a fucking torch and quit complaining. You think it's bright in the caves?
I think I preferred it when Hawk was teaching us. Gwenna mutters. I do too. 19. Aspeth. Despite our general helplessness, the evening isn't as bad as I expect it to be. Gwenna makes a fire, and we light a torch, only to find that the torch doesn't burn for very long at all. Magpie then produces an oil lantern and lectures us.
When I say come prepared, I mean it.
After the oil lantern is lit, we're tied together. Kip takes up the front, followed by Lark with the lantern. Gwenna follows behind her, then Meriden, then me in the back. We march up the slippery stream, and Magpie's right. It's only ankle deep. It's still incredibly treacherous, though, and we end up slogging with each step, our boots heavier with water every moment. I decide that I'm going to get myself a staff before anything else. A short one, so no one can gripe about my having it in close quarters. Maybe just to bosom height instead of past my shoulder. I like that idea. A staff to assist with walking, and to put a lantern atop, because not being able to see is maddening. Right now, I can't see anything except Meriden's backside and the coiling puff of her dark hair. We march up the stream, down the stream, up the stream again, this time in a different order, with me at the front.
This goes badly for all involved, and Magpie barks things at me like, "Are you blind?" I don't point out that, in fact, I am quite night-blind without my spectacles. We march up and down the stream until all three moons in the sky have disappeared again, and the night grows bitterly cold. Our teeth chatter, and Kip gets too cold to function, so we take turns carrying him.
Enough,
Hawk finally declares.
You've shown them you know what you're doing, Mags. Let them rest.
Oh, fine, she says. Though I know Hawk's just griping because he wants time with his wife. I suppose you all get a break. She claps her hands together. Now we make camp and another fire. What happened to the last bloody fire I made? Gwenna demands. Were you tending it? No, I've been marching upstream all night and scaring all the fish. Then it's out, isn't it? Magpie's smile is evil in the shadows. So make another fucking fire. You're not going to have anyone to depend on in the tunnels to keep things lit for you. Don't expect different out here. My job is to prepare you.
Gwenna shoots me an agitated look, as if she's blaming me for everything. I can't fault her for that. It is my fault that we're here, as fledglings. I suppose I deserve any and all blame. I'll make the fire. I can make it, Gwenna says. I know how.
You all need to learn how to make fire,
Magpie corrects. She points at me.
You make the fire. The others can set up their sleeping packs. Tomorrow, we practice sword work.
We all groan, with Kip's hiss carrying above the rest. I'm not sure if he's delighted or irked about the sword work. Probably a mixture of both, knowing Kip. Sometimes I'm not sure if he likes us or is just tolerating us to get to his endgame, being in the guild. Come to think of it, there are no Slitherskins in the guild at the moment, but no one objected to his fledglingship. Meanwhile, anyone with a pair of breasts was deemed a problem. I want to prove them wrong and make them regret their silly prejudices. I want them to have their eyes opened when we pass. I want them to be dumbstruck when they realize just how capable we are. It's yet another reason why we need to try so very hard to pass this first time around. Magpie won't get a second chance, and I suspect neither would we. It takes a long while, and Magpie barking some terse instructions, before I manage to figure out how to make a fire. But when it's finally going well, camp is set up. There are mini tents, and we can sleep two to a tent, with Kip preferring his round, cozy shell. Meriden and Gwenna will sleep in a tent together, and Lark will bunk with her aunt for tonight. When we're in the tunnels of the Ever Below, I won't be able to sleep with Hawk, of course. I blush just thinking about it. But it's not time to sleep just yet. Gwenna tosses a bunch of ingredients into a stew pot to start a meal, and we all relax by the fire, waiting while it bubbles.
So, Magpie says. Everyone's quiet regarding her.
She seems awkward now that we're relaxing and there are no orders to bark at us. I discreetly look around for Hawk, but he's on the edge of camp, leaning up against a tree and just watching us from afar.
I'm glad you're with us, Meriden says in her sweet voice.
She clasps her hands over her knees, looking young and innocent, her dark eyes gleaming in the firelight.
You have such a reputation with the guild. I was so excited to meet the legend of so many stories.
Instead of being flattered, Magpie looks embarrassed. She pats her pockets, grimaces, and when Lark passes her a skin of water, takes a swig from it instead.
Stories are just that. Stories. Sometimes exaggerated, and sometimes they don't matter at all. What matters is now.
She grimaces at the water,
and hands it back. Speaking of the here and now, have you all thought about names that you'll take when you pass?
I inwardly preen at her assumption that we'll pass. Sparrow, I say proudly. You can call me Sparrow.
Locke groans, rolling her eyes.
We know, we know.
Meriden giggles, her sleeve masking her smile.
There's nothing wrong with anticipating success, I point out, my back stiff. Your name is Locke, after all, and you don't see me harassing you about that.
That's because my mother named me that at birth,
Locke points out.
It was her idea. When I pass, maybe I'll change it up, be Mudlark or something.
Meriden just giggles louder.
Mudlark is a terrible name.
Oh, shut up,
Locke says, but there's a hint of a smile on her face.
Like you've picked out something better.
I haven't,
Meriden admits.
I haven't thought that far ahead. Maybe you can think of one for me.
Tit.
She scowls at Locke.
You know what? Forget I asked.
Bushtit, Gwenna says suddenly.
Locke howls with delight. Meriden frowns in her direction.
You're not helping.
I don't know. I thought Bushtit was pretty good,
Gwenna says with a smile.
It beats Chickadee, which is what Asbeth thought I should be at first. I think we settled on Wren.
Chickadee is a great name, I protest. They're very industrious birds, happy and busy. They make me think of you.
Perhaps I'm not very good at picking out names. But if you don't want to be Chickadee, you don't have to be. Meriden can be Chickadee.
Or not, Meriden says.
Magpie caps the water skin and slings the strap over her shoulder. Wren is a nice, unassuming name. Chickadee might be too feminine for all the cock-swinging you'll have to endure with the guild itself. Luckily enough, these names aren't taken. If I had a coin for every swaggering man who wanted to call himself Raven, I'd be rich.
Or Hawk, I blurt out immediately, thinking of him.
What about Hawk?
Magpie asks, and all eyes turn to me.
Yes, what about Hawk?
He says, chiming in, his gaze on me. My face flashes hot. I mean, it's just a common name, you know, very masculine. I'm sure a lot of men want that sort of name, something with a lot of swagger and testosterone. Not that it doesn't suit you, it does. You're very masculine. Very suited for something that aggressively male.
I pause, realizing that my words might make it seem as if Hawk is the type to beat me in private if I keep using words like aggressive.
Not aggressively male in a bad way, I just mean...
Go on.
He continues, his mouth drawing up in an amused smile.
Please continue to extol my masculinity.
If my face got any hotter, it'd be aflame. I mean, it's just very lucky that you managed to get the name that's perfect for you. You would think it wouldn't be available.
So, you think it's perfect for him?
Meriden's voice is so sweet.
That's adorable.
I didn't say that.
You did.
Hawk is giving me the most hard-to-read look. I can't tell if he's choking on laughter or just wants the conversation to end.
As for the name, it was timing. I knew the old Hawk. When he passed, I put in for the name first. I could have just as easily been Goose.
Goose? I sputter, forgetting we have an audience. Oh, you're far too masculine for something like Goose.
She sure keeps saying masculine a lot.
Locke mock whispers to Meriden.
Goddess, I'm just making things worse.
Kip!
I blurt instead, trying to distract. What about you? What name do you want? The Slitherskin shrugs, touching the tip of his tongue to his eyeball, and then moves to Magpie's side and pats a hand on her. The message is clear. She can pick it.
Something clever and quick, Magpie says. Swift, maybe.
He nods, and I suspect he's pleased. Luck snaps her fingers.
I just thought of the perfect name for Meriden.
The once priestess perks up.
Oh?
Swallow.
Meriden throws a stick at Luck while we all try desperately not to laugh. Time around the fire is nice. It's pleasant to laugh together and relax, to talk about our hopes and tease one another about names. We linger for an hour or two until Magpie pushes us off to bed.
Enough gossiping. Tomorrow's going to be a tiring day. You'll need your strength. Get some sleep.
We head off, and for the first time in hours, Hawk approaches me. He puts a hand to the small of my back, guiding me to the tent we'll be sharing. My face scorches again, as I suspect everyone is staring at us. I bite my lip as I duck into our lodgings. Your tent is bigger than the others.
Taurians are bigger than humans.
So they are. I've noticed Hawk has distinctly non-human proportions on certain parts of his anatomy. His thighs are absolutely enormous and nothing but rock-hard muscle. His biceps are as thick around as my thigh, and I'm not a small woman. Of course, he'd need a larger tent. I lie down on the pallet, a gilded issue pad to make sleeping on rock a little more bearable, and a matching scratchy wool blanket. And Hawk settles his big body next to mine, dominating the narrow space. I'm intensely aware of how big he is now that we're pressed close together, and the sheer size of his head and horns. His shoulders are huge, too, and he turns on his side, getting comfortable. He leans in, his muzzle near my ear, and his breath steams my skin.
How's this?
How's what?
Are you comfortable?
I clasp my hands over my blouse because I'm not sure where else to put them as I lie on my back. I mean, I don't have a pillow, I whisper, but I'm certain I'll get used to it.
Sit up,
he says, and when I do, he adjusts his large form and then indicates I should lie back down again. I do, and I'm cradled at the curve of his shoulder, resting against him. Oh, that was kind.
Better?
He asks. My skin prickles with awareness, my nipples tightening against my clothing as I think about last night, about licking. Somehow, when I'd imagined our marriage of convenience, I hadn't factored in pleasure. I thought we'd have sex, of course, but I hadn't thought beyond that. Now I can't stop thinking about Hawk touching me again. Hawk and his delightfully strange and thick tongue. A tongue that went all over me. Everywhere. Mercy, it's warm in this tent. I tug at my blouse, trying to air my cleavage.
Is something wrong?
He asks, voice low and secretive. No. I undo the top button on my blouse and pretend that was all I was up to. Just getting comfortable. I pull my hair down from its bun as well, tugging free tightly bound strands and fussing with it until my hair spills loose over his arm. There. See? All comfy now. He grunts. His grunt reminds me that he's been rather stony all night. Ever since Magpie took charge, Hawk's demeanor has been downright sour. Does he feel as if he's been passed over as a teacher? That we don't need him anymore? I turn and glance up at him,
and his mouth is pulled down in what can only be a Taurian frown. You've been acting strange tonight. That gets his attention.
Strange?
Yes. Dare I say it disapproving? Like you don't appreciate that Magpie has returned, that she's taken charge. Why is that? He rears back slightly, studying me.
I'm not disapproving. It's just, well, I've seen her like this before.
Like what?
Like her old self. Smart, capable, attentive.
Hawk shakes his head.
I've seen it happen before when she comes out of the bottle. She's great for a few days, and then something pisses her off or is difficult, and she reaches for the drink again. Then she's worse than before. I just don't want to get my hopes up.
I gaze up at him, sympathetic. He sounds so glum, and I want to fix this for him somehow. I wish I could. Sadly, I know he's right. There was a stable hand back at Honori Hold who drank too much. He'd get fired only to come crawling back, swearing he'd changed his ways. The new changes would last only a few days before he'd turn into a drunk again, and he'd get fired once more. The only reason he got another chance was because his wife was one of the cooks. I remember her crying constantly, her face buried in fistfuls of her apron. How she swore he was a good man when he wasn't drinking. It's just that he was always drinking. I think of Magpie, and it makes me ache with sadness to see my childhood hero like this. That today is likely just a fluke, and she'll go back to being the puking, miserable drunk she was before. Why do you stay with her if she's this bad, Hawk? It's clear everyone in the guild respects you. You could work for the guild masters directly. Work with the archivists. You could substitute in until you found a permanent five. Anyone would take you. Why are you wasting your time with Magpie if she's a lost cause? He's quiet for a long moment, thinking over my question. Then when he speaks, his voice is soft.
I owe her my life.
Go on. Hawk's so private that I wonder if he'll actually tell me. To my surprise, he doesn't hesitate.
I grew up in a very poor family. Many Taurians who live outside of the city are impoverished. They farm and grow crops, and that doesn't exactly bring the wealth the holders have.
I say nothing. I know all too well that holders have a great deal of coin. Well, usually. The venom in Hawk's voice makes me pause, though. Such vitriol has a history behind it, and I'm afraid to ask.
It's not uncommon for a young Taurian man to leave home the moment he's old enough to earn coin on his own. I was 12 when I left home.
12? I'm shocked. It's so very young.
I had 3 brothers and 4 sisters, and there was never enough food to go around. So when I hit the ripe old age of 12, I set out for Vast Warren to make my fortune. I was young and arrogant and full of myself. It went about as well as you'd expect.
There's a hint of amusement in his voice, but I can't even laugh. I just ache, thinking of a 12-year-old forced to leave his family behind because he wanted to have a full belly. Then there was me, still living at home at 30 and fretting because I didn't have enough coins for finery, for parties. Meanwhile, Hawk was just trying to survive to the next week. I'm a little ashamed of how disparate the fortunes of holders are in comparison to the poor. I know all too well that holders have a ridiculous amount of wealth and tax their landowners heavily so they can continue to acquire more artifacts to protect what they already have. It's a vicious cycle, and the moment you fall behind, everything collapses. Just as my father has had everything collapse around our family. A knot rises in my throat as Hawk continues.
I showed up at the guild hall and declared myself to be as capable as any students they had here already, and that even though it wasn't Swan's Day, I should be allowed to apprentice. They laughed in my face, and when I didn't give up, they told me if I could beat Osprey at the obstacle course, I would be allowed to join. He beat me handily, and all I got for my pride was a public shaming and the realization that I didn't know what I was going to do for a living. I slept two nights in the gutters before Magpie offered to buy me a drink. Said she felt sorry for me. I followed her home and showed up on her doorstep the next day, asking for work. Any work, no matter how difficult. At first she declined, but I kept showing up. And she started to give me errands. Running things to the guild hall, grabbing supplies from merchants, making sure the practice sword stayed sharp. I made a nuisance of myself, but I also made sure she saw that I could do the task she set for me. She gave me a place to stay, but I wasn't considered part of the guild. When I was 18, I was allowed to join as a fledgling, her fledgling. I passed my very first testing, excavated for 2 years, and then I lost my hand.
Lost your hand? I squint into the darkness, not sure I've heard him correctly.
Yes, I was in the tunnels with my five. They were idiots, looking back. But I was just happy to have work. Our navigator took us down a wrong turn, and a tunnel collapsed over us. My arm was pinned, and our healer buried under the rock. The others left us for dead.
I gasp. They left you.
It was self-preservation,
he says, voice bland.
If they'd have stayed, they'd likely have run out of air or encountered rattlings. They swarm after a tunnel collapse, looking for carrion. But they left us behind. I was there when the healer died, crying out for help until the end. I thought I was a goner, too. But it was just a matter of time. Don't know how long I was down there, pinned. 2 days, maybe? But then Magpie showed up. She'd heard they left me and brought her students down to come and save my arse. Rescued me and carried me out of the tunnels. My hand was crushed, so there was no choice but to amputate it. And just when I thought I could know her more, Magpie used her connections to acquire me a hand.
He lifts an arm and flexes it.
A magical limb from old Prel, grafted to my stump with words of magic.
I'm shocked. I didn't realize you had a false hand.
Most don't. It changes its appearance to match my skin and moves just like a real hand.
He rotates his hand in the air, flexing his fingers, and I can barely make out their outlines in the shadows.
There's not but a small line on my lower arm to show where it's connected. But if you run your fingers over my wrist, you can feel the glyphs carved there.
It's a siren call if ever there was one. May I?
Of course.
He extends his arm toward me, his palm open. Hesitant, I brush my fingers over his hand, wondering what it'll feel like. I'm not entirely surprised to find that it's warm. His skin like normal Taurian skin under my touch. Magic, like he said. I trace each finger and then run my hand over his palm. I move lower, encircling his wrist, and sure enough, I can feel the etchings of glyphs as if they've been carved into his skin. That's incredible.
It is. It feels like a real arm. A real hand.
He makes a fist as if proving to himself that it's possible.
But because it's an artifact, it's expensive. The guild agreed to sell it to me rather than to one of the holders. I suspect it would have been a different story if one of the holders was in need of a right hand, but since I was the only one, it came to me.
He flexes his fingers again.
Now I must pay the guild back for its largesse. And to do so, I need students that tithe to Magpie's Nest.
Of course.
because that's how guild brokering works. Teachers don't go into the tunnels, so they're paid via tithe from graduating students. If no students graduate, there's no money coming in. No wonder Hawk is so very stressed. Magpie is at risk of losing her job and becoming homeless, and Hawk... well, Hawk could lose his entire hand. So, it's more important than ever that we get things right. Not just for Magpie, but for you, too.
Indeed.
I reach up and play with his fingers, thinking, there has to be something I can do, some sort of string I can pull. As a Holder's heir, I'm used to being the one with all the power. People listen to Lady Aspeth Honori. People fear getting on her bad side. But here, I'm just Aspeth who wants to be Sparrow. I'm just another student. And if I interfere, it'll cause more problems. Money would solve things. Money would solve things for both of us. But it's the one thing I don't have, even with all the power of my family name. I think of my father, and then I think how he would react if he knew I married a Taurian just so I could apprentice. He'd be horrified at both the Taurian and the apprenticing. My father is a Holder who believes firmly that grunt work should be left to, well, grunts. Lessers. I don't think of Hawk as my lesser, though. If I'm being honest, he's better than me. And most humans at absolutely everything he puts his mind to. I don't think of Magpie, Lark and the others as lesser either. Or Gwenna, despite the fact that she was my servant for years prior to coming here. We've bonded over the last several days of exercises, helping one another with the ropes that tie us together, or laughing when someone makes a mistake. We share our successes and pick one another up when we fail. They're my companions. My friends. I don't think I've had friends before now, and the thought is a sobering one. I know of every family in society, of course. I know which Holder's son is married to which daughter, and who lives where, and their crests, and who tithes to them. I know about them all. And yet, I don't know them. The thought of telling any of them of my guild adventures is utterly terrifying. They wouldn't understand. I grew up with the nobility, and yet I'm a stranger to all. Sad. I continue to toy with Hawk's large fingers, marveling at the magic that makes it feel as real as flesh and blood. It's strange. His hand is so warm and so big, and yet I wouldn't know it was magical if he hadn't told me. It's fascinating to think of how much he's overcome. There are sides to him I'm unaware of, pieces I haven't yet learned. That's rather exciting. He's an interesting person, my strange new husband. I tug on one fingertip, wondering how it must have felt to lose a hand and then regain it. Tell me more about this. What does it feel like? Does it feel different, or does it feel like your hand? How does the magic work? Can you do fine movements with the artifact? Is there loss of motion? His chest rumbles, and I realize after a moment that he's laughing quietly, the chuckles vibrating his big body. What's so funny? I turn and frown up at his form in the darkness. It's a legitimate question, and we're in this business because of artifacts, yes? Why wouldn't I want to learn more about one that's attached to you? Hawk strokes his magic hand over my belly, his fingers teasing at my blouse.
Do you truly want to know how it feels?
Isn't that what I asked? I sound breathless and uncertain as he toys with the waistband of my clothing. Is he...
My breath completely escapes me as his hand slides under my clothes and cups my pussy. One thick finger strokes in the cleft of my sex, and I'm shocked to realize I'm already incredibly wet. He circles my clit, teasing it, and whispers in my ear.
Tell me if you think I have good control over my hand,
Lips parted, I make a choked sound as he continues to toy with the sensitive flesh. His finger feels scorching hot against my skin, and he moves slowly and maddeningly, each languid circle driving me more and more insane. I look up at him, at his big, strange face, his eyes gleaming in the dark. My hands curl against his chest, and I have no words to speak. I can only feel and feel and feel. He adds another finger, and then he's rubbing back and forth, caressing my clit from both sides. I make a whimpery noise, and he leans in closer.
Shh, you're supposed to be sleeping, naughty thing.
I grab double handfuls of his shirt, twisting the fabric as his fingers slip over my slick heat. Gods, I'm so wet. His strokes are just gliding over my skin, and every so often I can hear the wet sound of my pussy, just loud enough for it to fill the tent. I should be horrified, but instead I'm so aroused that it only turns me on more. Panting, I cling to him, trying to keep quiet. The climax builds and I lean forward, grabbing a mouthful of his shirt and biting down on it to stifle the scream in my throat as my legs jerk and I come, soaking his hand with my release. He keeps rubbing me, whispering my name, until he wrings a second orgasm out of me in quick succession.
Does that answer your question?
He murmurs in my ear. I can't even remember the question. 20. Aspeth. 19 days before the conquest moon. Day 2 in the woods is miserable. It rains upon us all night long, and we're shivering in cold. The fire won't stay lit, and no one's in a good mood. We're beset by swarms of bugs that bite and sting every exposed inch of skin, and I slap at my arms and legs repeatedly, because the dratted things even bite me through my clothes. Hawk seems to be in a foul mood after that night's training, and after being bitten by bugs and listening to Magpie screech at us about how terrible we are, the last thing I want is to be stuck in a closed tent with an equally grumpy Taurian. He's been so snarly all night, and it irritates me. I'm reminded of my etiquette teacher's words, that you can win far more suitors with sweets than with vinegar. And so I paste a smile to my face despite my fatigue. I'm going to charm my husband, damn it all. So I take off my sweaty guild coat and unlace my corset so I can breathe, relaxing. I pull off my boots and lie back atop the blankets because the day is warm and the sun is beating down upon our tent outside. At least it's somewhat dark in here. Since we're training in the night, we're having to sleep during the day. Hawk stomps in, his mood as foul as it was earlier, and I don't comment upon it. I just stretch, enjoying the feeling of being able to relax and not carrying a heavy pack upon my back. He tosses his coat down on the bottom of the tent, his jaw clenched, and then all but rips his shirt off. That gets my attention. I watch as his broad muscles flex, the russet color of his body and coat fascinating and shiny. It makes each muscle seem highlighted, as if drawing attention to just how corded and taut his arms are, or how his pectorals are nothing but thick planes built by even more muscle. He scratches at his waist, and my fingers twitch with the need to touch him, to run my hands over all that physical power. Goddess, I never thought I was one of those women to get the vapors at the sight of a strong chest, but I see now that I was wrong, because looking at a half-naked hawk is making me feel fluttery and distracted. If I reached for him, would he slap me away with a flick of his tail? Or would he welcome my exploring hands? I wish I knew. Hawk? He grunts, acknowledging that he's heard me. My nerve deserts me. I curl my fingers into fists and decide to go for conversation instead. Propping my head on my folded arm, I turn on my side and watch him as he pulls off his belt in preparation for sleep. Tell me about you.
Tell you about me?
Yes, please.
I have a new wife who needs to go to sleep.
He says in a terse voice. A mosquito lands on my arm and I slap it with annoyance. Hawk goes still.
What was that?
Mosquito.
Ah.
He shakes his head.
Pests are out today. The Dark God must be in a good mood to send so many of his servants to annoy us.
Or they're just plentiful because we're in the woods, I reply, and then return to my initial subject. So you won't talk to me about you?
You should go to sleep.
No, I should get to know my husband, since we're going to be sharing a marriage bed and all. I keep a smile on my face, though it's not hard to do now that he's nude, except for his pants, and is easing his big body down onto the ground next to me. I think about being in the tent with him the other night, and how he'd pushed his fingers into my pants and touched me until I came, and my thighs clenched together, because I want to do that again, and I don't know how to ask. Hawk rolls his eyes and adjusts the blankets under his body. I notice he's not getting under the covers, either.
Fine. What do you want to know?
You don't have to sound so put upon. It was a simple request. He tugs on the ring on his nose.
None of this gives me a good feeling.
You and me? I'm hurt, because this feels as if it is coming out of nowhere. I know we're still getting to know each other, but surely he doesn't feel the marriage was a mistake, does he? But Hawk glances over at me in surprise. He rolls onto his side, facing me.
No, sorry. I should have been clearer. I meant I don't have a good feeling about your five, about Magpie being involved.
He reaches out and runs a fingertip down my nose, tracing the length of it as if fascinated by its size.
You're actually the only one I do have a good feeling about.
Warmth threads itself through my body, and I'm desperate for more touching. I didn't realize how much I craved it until I married Hawk. I always wished the staff, or my father, would hug me when I was back at the hold, but I knew those embraces wouldn't happen. Now that I'm married and Hawk touches me, it's an addiction I want to feed. I need him to touch me constantly. I need him to reach for me. I need him to pull me close and tuck me against him. Or put his hands in my pants again. Truly, I'm fine with either. But his words of flattery, as lovely as they are just as surprising. If you think I'm competent, why are you so mean to me? Hawk chuckles, the sound low and sensual, and my nipples harden in response.
I didn't say you were competent, little bird. But I trust you to have good sense when it comes to being in the tunnels. It's clear you've studied the guild and the ruins, which is more than I can say for the others. If anyone in your group will pass, I think it's you.
He traces my nose again, and then moves down to the divot between my nose and my lip.
But that's why I have to be so hard on you. The guild will be suspicious because we are married. You have to show that you're an excellent student no matter what is thrown at you.
His teasing finger is making my blood heat. I want to suck on his fingertip. I want to touch his cock. I want... Something crawls over his bare arm. A tiny spider. I automatically reach out and flick it off his shoulder.
What was that?
He growls, his tail thudding hard against the ground. Spider, it's gone now. Nasty little creatures. I fight back a yawn. To my surprise, Hawk jerks to his feet and abandons the tent. Where are you going?
Need to talk to Magpie.
Is all he calls back, voice strangely tight. Rude. Rude to just up and leave after teasing me like that. With a huff of annoyance, I close my eyes and try to go to sleep.
Hawk. Being in the tent with Aspeth each day is the sweetest torture. At night, when they're marching through the woods, it's easy to push down any feelings of affection. It's easy to focus on the task ahead of us, of training the fledglings. Magpie seems to be in a good mood, almost too good. She swears she's not drinking, but she also won't let me sniff her breath, so I don't know that I believe her. It's hard to trust again after so long. But Aspeth's presence makes this better than most fledgling trainings. After I checked everything thoroughly for spiders, I returned to the tent to find Aspeth still awake. We talked when we should have been resting. Just lay on our sides and discussed everything and nothing. It was nice. Real nice. Nice to have someone I can talk to and who sees the situation for what it is. Nice to have an equal who isn't a staggering drunk. I might be Aspeth's teacher, but it's clear after a few hours of conversation that she could teach me a lot about old Prell, and I enjoy her intelligence. I actually look forward to our next rest period in the tent. Once the training is done for the night and Magpie is sweaty and pale with fatigue, I tap Aspeth on the shoulder. Time for bed.
Oh.
Lark coos because she's ridiculous. At her side, Meriden giggles behind her hand. You all need to get some rest, I tell them sternly. My cock is reacting to the conquest moon and to Aspeth's nearness. And by the time we get into the tent, I'm rock hard and aching. Not that I'd rut my soft little wife here in the woods. But bury me, I sure do think about it. We undress in silence, and then Aspeth lets out a sigh of pleasure, scratching at the chemise she wears under her corset.
Gods, that feels good.
I grunt, adjusting my cock surreptitiously. Get some sleep. But my wife never listens to anything I say. I can't decide if I find it amusing or irritating, but I'm leaning toward amusing. She lies atop the blankets again, her nipples poking against the fabric of her chemise, and stifles a yawn as she gazes up at me.
No sleep. This is our get-to-know-each-other time, and I plan on taking full advantage of it. What's the most beautiful thing you've ever found in the Everbelow?
Her question makes me chuckle, because of course Aspeth wants to know all about the job. You mean the most expensive thing? The most powerful? She turns on her side and tucks her arm under her head again, gazing at me as I lie down.
No, I mean the most beautiful. Old Prell was full of all kinds of beautiful works, and not just magical ones. I've seen drawings of Prellian frescoes that would put modern artists to shame. I've read about glorious architecture. I can't wait to see it all. I was just curious what you'd seen. It doesn't have to be an artifact.
Her eyes gleam with a dreamy expression.
I wish I could have seen Prell in its height of power. I bet it was splendid.
It also fell into the ground at its height of power. You wouldn't want to be around for that. Aspeth bats at my arm, chuckling.
Don't ruin my dreams.
I consider her words, lying on my back and gazing up at the ceiling of the tent. A blanket strategically placed over my cock. Her hand remains on my arm, touch lingering. And it's making my erection remain as hard and aching as ever. I used to go in the tunnels all the time when I first joined the guild. I do it less now, or rather, I do it for artifacts less now. I end up on more retrieval missions than anything. But I remember that I found a mirror once, and it made me stop in my tracks.
A mirror?
She breathes.
How incredible. Was it broken?
I shake my head. It was wrapped in fabric in a tunnel, just wedged in some rocks near an old cave-in. Perhaps a thief tried to steal it and decided not to bother and left it behind. But when I found it, there was nothing else around. No ruins, no other artifacts, just that solitary, wrapped mirror. Holding my hands in the air, I try to shape it with my fingers. It was about the size of a platter and clear as day. All around the edges, the metal was worked so delicately that it looked like vines covered in flowers. And every flower was a different size and shade. Every leaf, every petal, all of it was made from colored gemstones. A few of them had chipped and cracked, but it was still gorgeous.
How beautiful. Was it magical?
That's the ironic part. I chuckle at the memory. The only thing the mirror did was make your hair seem a dark, rich black in the reflection. Got rid of the grays. And if your hair wasn't black, it adjusted your reflection. Useless.
Someone was sensitive about his hair, then.
Aspeth replies with a soft smile.
How funny that they were a people who imbued magic into everything they owned, and were a people with no magic at all.
That's because all the Mancers went crazy 300 years ago. Better to not have magic. At least with a magic mirror, you can put the mirror away.
I suppose.
Her smile grows broader as she gazes up at me.
Have you ever found something you wished you could keep?
You. The foolish thought bubbles up and I push it away, because it's likely moon-induced. Ours is a marriage of convenience. Nothing more.
21. Aspeth. 17 days before the conquest moon. When night 4 in the woods arrives and we're still doing drills, I decide they're doing this to torture us. We go up the stream, down the stream, up the stream again, but this time tied in a different formation. We go up and down the stream with weapons drawn, without a lantern, all of us carrying lanterns. All of us carrying lanterns with our pack weight doubled to simulate if we found a stash of treasures. Not even a few stolen touches in the tent can make this any better. Not that there's been many of those lately either. After that first explosive interlude when Hawk made me come, I've been aching for him to touch me again. Aching. Instead, we just talk. And while I find talking to him joyous and incredibly satisfying, he's as fixed on old Prel as me in some ways, I wish he would touch me again. I think it's my fault. I told him I wanted to get to know him during rest times in the tent, and I think he interpreted that to mean I didn't want to be touched until we knew each other better. Is it greedy to want both? I certainly don't think so. Magpie grows steadily more ornery as the nights pass as well. She doesn't look so good. Her hands shake with tremors constantly, and she sweats even when it's cold. Her face is pale, her eyes are hollows, but she's determined to keep us moving. She's grumpy, too. She yells at us constantly to pick up our feet, or to move faster, or to swing a sword harder, to make a fire faster. In short, she's horrible. Hawk isn't much better. He doesn't speak much outside of our rest times inside our tent alone, and when he does, it's to point out something our 5 is doing wrong, that we're going to fail if we keep going as we are, that we need to shape up, do better. We're giving everything we've got, and yet it's still not good enough for him or for Magpie.
You're using your eyes too much.
Hawk tells me, batting aside my attempts to stab with my training sword.
I can predict where you're going with your weapon. Quit projecting.
I'm not projecting. At my next stab,
He makes another growl of frustration and bats me aside again, as easily as batting away a fly.
Eyes.
What else am I supposed to do? I sputter, even as I stab and faint again. My vision is blurry, and I'm focused more on shapes and colors than actual objects. But I can't let him know that. They're eyes. They're meant for looking.
And in the tunnels, your lighting is going to be almost nothing. The shadows are going to trick your vision. You need to rely on your other senses when you fight, Aspeth, or we're going to have to break out the mucking blindfolds again.
I make a frustrated sound and stab again, just as he's taught me. Hawk parries me easily, and when I stab at him wildly a second time, he smacks my hand with his blocking staff. Yelping, I drop my blade and bring the back of my hand to my mouth. My skin stings at the contact, but more than anything, I'm humiliated. I can't tell him that I can't see enough to follow his lessons other than the broad gestures. I can't tell him that I'm doing good just to not run into walls. I have to pretend like I can see as well as anyone else. This is something I can't master, and I can't tell him that. I need a moment. I walk away, sucking on the back of my hand, determined not to cry. Tears of frustration don't solve anything. They won't make me better at sword work. They won't fix my vision. They won't get me into the guild. So I need to channel that helpless anger into something else.
Aspeth!
Hawk calls after me. I said I need a moment, I call back, walking into the thick copse of trees. Let me be, and then I'll come back to training. I keep walking, and my frustration mounts when I can hear him crashing through the underbrush behind me. I hike a little faster, only for him to keep following me, as if what I want doesn't matter. It only adds to my bad mood, and by the time I hit a good spot to sit and relax, I turn and glare at the big bull man who has followed me all this time. What part of I said I need a moment did you fail to understand? He ignores my bad mood and marches right up to me and takes my hand, turning it over and examining it.
Did I hurt you?
Oh, it stung, but you did the same to the others.
I'm not married to the others.
He lifts the back of my hand to his muzzle and rubs his nose against my skin.
I'm sorry. I was trying to be gentle with you, and instinct kicked in.
I don't want you to be gentle with me, I tell him, distracted as he continues to rub his muzzle against my skin in a way that makes me feel shivery inside. I want you to treat me the same as the others.
But you're not the same,
he murmurs, and his golden gaze meets mine.
You're my wife, and I'm supposed to be teaching you about pleasure. I don't like seeing you hurt.
His response leaves me flustered. It's not like it's been about pleasure over the last few days. You haven't touched me since the first day we got here.
Missing it?
Oh, gods. My face heats. I mean, no.
Liar.
He grins, his expression practically feral as he releases my hand and takes another step forward. I automatically take a step back and stumble over roots, only to find myself with my back against the nearest tree. His hand goes to my waist, and then he flicks open my belt and slides his hand into my pants. Sucking in a breath at the feel of his warm fingers against my skin, I flick my gaze up to him. What are you doing?
Making you feel better.
The heat in his eyes is playful, even as he cups the back of my neck with his other hand and draws a teasing circle around my clit. The pose makes me gaze up at him, and when I brace a hand on his chest, I can see a smile curving his mouth.
You sounded sad that I haven't touched you lately. I'm making it up to you.
You don't... I wasn't.
Shh. I know, little bird.
He strokes against my clit, and my knees almost buckle.
I have you.
My lips part, and anything I want to say, to protest, disappears from my mind as he keeps touching me. His fingers dance through my folds, slicking them with my juices. And when he dips a finger into the heat of my channel, my body makes a wet squelch. I jerk, startled and embarrassed. Hawk only hums with pleasure.
Feel how wet you are, Aspeth. When the moon is upon me, the more I touch you, the more slick your body will create so you can take me. You're going to be twice as wet as this. So wet that it runs down your thighs and soaks the bed. It's all so I can stretch you to take my knot. And it'll make you feel so good.
He eases his finger into me again, his thumb moving to rub my clit as he does. And then he starts a slow, regular motion, pumping into me with his hand. His gaze is locked on mine as I curl my hands in his shirt, clinging to him as he pushes me toward a climax. When I come, it's with a muffled cry, my face pressed against his chest as he keeps fingering me. Pleasure bursts through my mind and sweeps down my legs, and then it rolls through me, leaving me sated and weak-kneed. Oh, that was nice.
It was.
He rubs his muzzle against my ear, as if drinking in my scent. I wasn't begging for you to touch me, I tell him primly. I just thought that we were supposed to be spending our time here in the woods getting to know each other. Our time alone, that is.
Oh, we are.
He chuckles, amused at my prissiness.
I'm getting to know which touches make you squeal, and that you talk about old Prel in your sleep.
I wriggle until I free his possessive hand from my body and slip away from him, flushed with embarrassment. I do not. He licks his finger clean of my taste with lascivious strokes of his tongue that make me think all kinds of naughty things.
You do, and it's charming. Last night you were discovering bowls in your sleep.
Last night was actually last day, since we've been sleeping in the daytime. But I don't correct him. I'm a little too mortified that he's right. I do have vague dreams of unearthing glowing bowls from a big pile of rocks. What kinds of bowls? Hawk chuckles, his expression amused and full of affection as he gazes at me.
I don't know. You kept saying it was a secret.
Normally, I'd be fixated on the soft expression my new husband is giving me. But all I can think about is that I'm talking about secrets in my sleep. Is real life bleeding over into my dreams? Have I mentioned anything about my father and his hold? His need for artifacts? I need to distract Hawk from this line of thought so he doesn't pay too much attention if I do so again. You know, Prelian bowls were a very important part of mealtimes. They had different sized bowls and different colors of bowls depending on what was being served and at what time. It was considered poor manners to serve anything in a large bowl at the first meal of the day, for example. It implied you were greedy. If a wife wanted to get on her husband's bad side, she'd keep increasing the size of a bowl, a subtle insult. The Taurian chuckles, shaking his head at me.
That's one of the things I like about you, Aspeth. When you get cornered, you start teaching history lessons about old Prel. By the time you get to be a guildmaster, I'll be as much of an expert as you are, because you'll have told me so much.
His words make me pause. You truly think I'll get there?
If anyone will, it's you.
He smiles. I want to preen at his approval. The afternoon, when we start our fifth day in the woods, begins with a drizzling rain, and my boots squish with every step I take. It's the breaking point. The cloak I wear is wet, the socks on my feet are soaked. Everything is covered in mud and damp and cold, and I've had enough. This is ridiculous, I exclaim, parking my feet at the edge of the stream before we can tie ourselves together for yet another water hike. I turn around to glare at Magpie and Hawk. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Gwenna, Lark, and Meriden look just as miserable as I am. Even Kip looks a little weary. The big shell of his house hangs lower on his shoulders than it should, a sign that even someone with his expertise can grow tired of this nonsense.
You know why,
Hawk says, voice harsh. For a moment, I regret I didn't ask him to go easy on me because I'm his wife. He's just as hard on me, if not harder, than anyone else. Next to him, Magpie winces and holds her head. She's looking just as sorry as the rest of us, her clothes wet and muddy, her eyes hollowed out. She acts as if she has a headache, too. We're going to be in tunnels, I feel the need to point out. Not this. I extend my hands, gesturing at the rain pattering down on us, and then indicate the mud at my feet. There's no rain